Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we are broadcasting today from the floor of the Los Angeles Religious Ed Congress. I think it's like 30, 40,000 Catholics come here each year, and we are delighted to be at the EWTN booth. EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network is here, of course, because you're not going to get 40,000 Catholics together and EWTN doesn't show up, and we are delighted to be able to broadcast from their booth. Our guest this hour drove all the way up from San Diego to be here with us, Carlo Broussard. Hi, Carlo.
Hey, Cy. Not quite San Diego. Marietta.
Oh, yeah, right. You came from home. You didn't go down.
It's halfway.
Yep. Yeah. Fair enough. Carlo, as you know, is the author of Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church, and is the apologist and speaker extraordinaire there at Catholic Answers. And today, we talk about...
Which Catholic doctrine troubles you?
And this is one of your more popular ones. People like to call in, tell us, look, hey, Carlo, I don't agree with what the Church teaches about the ordination of men only.
Right, or something like that.
How can you say that Mary was immaculately conceived? So if there's something like that, there's some doctrine of the Catholic Church, some teaching of the Catholic Church, that you say either that you have rejected and you'd like to discuss it with us, or maybe you just have a problem with. I don't fully understand that. I don't know how I can get on board with that. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. The Religious Ed Congress brings together, as I said, thousands and thousands of Catholics, but also a diverse number of speakers. Mm-hmm. And some we would say, they're right on the money. And we have to be honest about it here. Some of the speakers here, we might say, well, I'm not exactly sure how that fits with Catholic teaching. We've run across that.
Sure.
So you get the whole wide variety. That's fine. I don't think we're hurting anybody's feelings to say that. But... So it might be that someone would come here would have a problem with one of the things that I see, some of the sexual teachings
Sure.
of the Catholic Church.
Sure.
That might be, might say, well, it's not fair what Catholics teach about gay marriage or something
Right.
like that. Would you take questions on that if someone were to come up to you and say something like that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. When any sort of obstacle that somebody is facing that's impeding them or prohibiting them from embracing Catholicism, or perhaps somebody out there who's trying to evangelize someone and has come across an obstacle that that person is facing, and they need help in trying to help that person overcome that obstacle, particularly a Catholic doctrine, you know, whether that doctrine has to do with faith and that pertaining to God's revelation about what we need to believe about God, about creation, about the sacraments, perhaps, but also to certain teachings that pertain to the moral life. And we're willing to take those sort of questions as well. As you mentioned, Cy, very often the Church's teachings concerning human sexuality often stand in the way of someone embracing the truth of Catholicism. And so it's important that we try and articulate the Church's teaching in a way that is rooted in our human nature, that's grounded in what we are as human beings, and that which we can know by the natural light of human reason, in order to show the coherence and the harmony between what we know about our human sexuality by reason, right, and what God reveals to us about the human being made in the image and likeness of God and our eternal destiny being in heaven with Him. And we see how those things cohere and are in harmony. So we see a beautiful synthesis of faith and reason, whether it's we're talking about, you know, the Eucharist or the papacy or even Jesus and who He is and the Trinity, or whether we're talking about certain moral teachings concerning our human sexuality.
That number again, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH, if you prefer the spelled out version. Lots of calls already, Carlo. Shall we take a call?
Yeah, sure. Let's go to it.
Let's go to Nate in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Nate, your question for Carlo Broussard.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I know that Aquinas and a couple other Church fathers and theologians have famously said that part of the joy of saints and people in heaven will be derived from being able to witness or see the suffering and the torment of the people in hell. And is that true? Is that doctrine? And if so, that bothers me.
Yeah, so I understand your point. Concerning the question of is it definitive church teaching? Like, do we find it in magisterial texts? I'm not quite sure. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, Nate, where we would find what Aquinas articulates in the Summa Theologiae as well as the Summa Contra Gentiles. If we find that embodied within magisterial teaching, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I'd have to do a little bit more research. But given what Aquinas says about it, I actually wrote an article on this and it's published at Catholic.com. Nate, you can check it out. I'm not quite sure exactly what's the title of the... here it is. How can we be happy on earth knowing there are people in hell? And that's from January 10th, 2017. I answered a brief question and gave a brief answer. But I also, as well, have an article on it that you can try to research at Catholic.com. And basically, the idea is, number one, there is happiness in being aware of those who are in hell in that we see God's justice manifest in those who have definitively rejected him and are definitively separated from him in hell. So there is a sense in which we rejoice in God's justice, and seeing that justice is a source of our happiness. Secondly, in the beatific vision, Nate, we come to see clearly that just how majestic and how glorious God is and how evil sin is. So that in light of that knowledge and a clear awareness of God's majesty and how evil sin is, we see the justice in that these souls are definitively separated from God. And so there's no longer any pity. There's no, as Aquinas articulates, there's no possibility for us to pity the souls in hell. Number one, because we know they can't change their choice because of the irrevocability of choice upon death for an incorporeal being, right? So the choice becomes irrevocable right after death, right, where the soul can no longer choose the good, but it's fixed in the evil. So because they can no longer change their choice, we cannot possibly pity them in that we desire them to choose the good. And then secondly, we don't pity them because we see the gravity of their choice to choose something else as their ultimate end as opposed to God. And so, as I articulate in the article online at Catholic.com, I give these reasons along with some others, trying to explain how Aquinas articulates this idea of how the blessed in heaven can be happy knowing that, even while knowing those souls and which souls are in hell. And Aquinas does toss out the idea that knowledge of their state gives us a source of our happiness for our state. Like, we are able to see the contrast of our beatitude versus torment being separated from him, and thanking God for his grace in moving us in a way that we could cooperate with him, so that we're grateful that we are in heaven and not in hell. So these are some of the lines of reasoning that Aquinas articulates, in which I point out in my article, but unfortunately I can't remember the exact title. So if you go in on Catholic.com and just in the search engine type in happy and hell or something of that nature, it should pop up.
Okay, Nate? It's just that I don't advocate for torture. I don't advocate for death penalty. I advocate for life in prison, where someone can, you know, read books for the rest of their life. They can become productive or reform if that's within them. But I would be happy if justice was served, so long as they weren't tortured or punished or in torment for eternity. If they're just, you know, not where they could cause more harm or damage. So the fact that torment is the justice, and that torment and justice is providing happiness to others, is something that still bothers me. So I guess I'll have to wrestle with that.
Yeah. I see your point, Nate. And here's the key. One thing that helped me in thinking through that, Nate, as Aquinas points out, is we do not rejoice, and I'm glad you brought this up because it's important that we make this clarification. We do not rejoice in the torment and in the suffering itself as an end in and of itself. we rejoice only in as much as this torment and this suffering is annexed to or conjoined with, sort of associated with God's justice. So we rejoice in God's justice, and the suffering is conjoined to that. So we would say in philosophy and theology, it's accidental. It's not the essential cause and source of our joy. It's not like we're rejoicing, yeah, they're suffering and we're wishing them evil. No, we're rejoicing in God's justice, and their suffering is associated with that. So we do not rejoice in their suffering as an end in and of itself, only in as much as it is conjoined with the justice of God and the justice that is manifest in their definitive separation. And keep in mind, Nate, that the primary suffering of hell is from within and being deprived of the beatific vision, the only source of their complete happiness. And as Aquinas articulates, that there is a secondary element of suffering of hell where it is imposed in the sense that this is called traditionally the pain of sense, in the sense that the soul has chosen to make creaturely goods as their final end as opposed to the ultimate end of God, there is indeed a secondary form of punishment, although the primary form is the deprivation or the pain of loss, of losing the beatific vision. So all of those things are kind of in play here. I would encourage a few articles, if you go online as well, and research Edward Fazer, Dr. Edward Fazer, on his blog. He has a few online articles on hell. You brought up the idea of punishment, and he has a great articulation of punishment. And in order to substantiate the claim that punishment considered in and of itself, Nate, is not a bad thing. In fact, it is a good thing when it is employed, properly speaking, according to reason. Being that God is pure reason itself, he can employ punishment in a perfectly just way. But if your problem is with punishment, then we have to, therein lies the heart of the discussion. And Dr. Edward Fazer has some excellent online articles that you can access for free on his blog. Just type in Fazer in Hell, and the list of those articles will pop up for you.
Nate, we'll have to leave it there. I hope that was helpful. Thank you very, very much for that call. 888-318-7884 is our number. Carlo Broussard is our guest. Carlo is the author of Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. And today we're asking you a question. Which Catholic doctrine troubles you? If you've got trouble with one of the Catholic doctrines, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Don't forget, the annual spring store-wide sale continues at shop.catholic.com. Just put in the promo code SPRING19 when you check out at shop.catholic.com. Get 15% off your entire order.
Hi, this is Bishop James Wall from the Diocese of Gallup, New Mexico. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit MysticMonkCoffee.com. That's MysticMonkCoffee.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I love listening to Catholic Radio. It's perfect. It provides peace and it builds us up and strengthens us. We listen to it whenever we're in the car. My husband and I love it. He got me started with it before he even became a Catholic. He owns his own business and so he's working by himself and he listens to Catholic Radio and he's called in several times too. It's using the technology that we have for good.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and I'm just having so much fun because we're broadcasting from the floor of the Religious Ed Congress, the Los Angeles Religious Ed Congress, held each year at the Anaheim Convention Center, across the street from Disneyland, which is always interesting to see the two crowds mixing, ours. Right. All the folks who teach religious ed in parishes all around the country, and then little girls dressed up as the Little Mermaid on their way over to Disneyland. It's awesome on the sidewalks outside here. Carlo Broussard is our guest. Carlo's book, of course, is Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. And if there's a Catholic doctrine that troubles you, we would love to take your call today, 888-318-7884. Let's go to Robert on line five. Robert, your question for Carlo.
Hi. Hello?
Hey, Robert. Robert. Speak right into the phone. We got a lot of noise here, so right into the phone will help us.
Okay.
Your question for Carlo?
Yeah. Okay. They asked me to switch to the phone. Okay, I'm sorry. Are we spiritual beings having a human experience, or is our body and soul really one thing?
Oh,
okay. Very, very, very good question, Robert. Okay, so the passage in the Catechism, now this is a very deep philosophical question that you're asking here, Robert, which unfortunately the limitations and the scope of our time here on the radio doesn't permit me to go into great detail. And it's very nuanced. But the key text in the Catechism is in paragraph 365. And the Catechism is articulating that, so first of all, the soul and the body are distinct in that the soul is not the body and the body is not the soul, because the soul, which we know by the natural light of human reason as well as from divine revelation, it is an immaterial principle of the human being, right? It's that which makes the human being a living being, but it's also that which allows the human being to have the variety of powers that it has, powers that are related to the body, such as nutrition and growth and reproduction and sensory powers. But the human soul also allows the human being to have immaterial, non-corporeal powers, powers that go beyond what is done in and through the body, such as intellectual reasoning, right? Knowledge, coming to know abstract concepts and making judgments about reality, what is true, what is false, and then also reasoning, right? From like one premise, all men are mortal. Second premise, Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So the soul is distinct from the body. But yet, Robert, it's important, as the Catechism points out, the soul and the body are not two separate substances, right? So like a substance, Psy is a substance. Carlo is a substance.
A little too much of a substance over here.
That person over there is a substance. We are distinct substances. The soul and the body are not distinct substances, you know, existing of themselves in their own right. They are a unity, conjoined, combined, right, united within one substance. So both the soul and the body together make up the one substantial reality, namely that human being over there, right? And so the Catechism employs the language of Aristotle, right, and how the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle articulated the soul as the form of the body, right? So you got the matter, the stuff, and the form is that which makes the matter a particular kind of thing rather than some other kind of thing. And so the Catechism is saying is because the soul and the body are so united in such an intimate way, both together make up a single nature. They make up a single substantial reality. So they are distinct, but they're not two separate substances that are somehow joined. They're distinct principles, but joined in such a way that together they make up one single nature. They make up a single substantial reality. And that's paragraph 365 in the Catechism, Robert. So hopefully that's helpful to you. What do you think, brother?
Well, I think that's great. I'm going to go kind of hone just for 1 second. So the statement of I'm a spiritual being having a human experience is at best inartful.
Well, you are a spiritual being, but you're also a material being, because both the spiritual principle, soul, and the material principle, body, together make up you. So you're both a spiritual and material being. But it would be incorrect to say you're merely a spiritual being, because that would be angelism, right? You'd be claiming you're like the angels, who are pure spirits in their very being, in their very nature, and what they are. They're pure spirits. They don't have a body that is essential to their nature and what they are. Whereas we as human beings, we have a spiritual principle, the rational spiritual soul. But because we are human beings, our bodies are essential to what we are as humans. This is why the separated soul is in an incomplete state of existence. It's not a the separated soul is not a full human being in the fullness of human nature, because the body belongs united to the soul in order to be fully human. So we are spiritual beings, but we're also material beings. But both principles together make up the single being that you are.
Robert, I hope that that's helpful. It's not easy. Thanks for the call, Robert. It's not easy, Carlo. But the thing that I find most helpful is when you say you're one substance, you're a human, and then you work from there.
That's right.
So now that's why we resurrection of the body is so important.
Amen. Right? Amen. This is why the church from the very get-go has proclaimed the resurrection of the body, is because the body is essential to human who we are as human beings. And so it's fitting that God would will that he would resurrect the body and reunite the body to the separated souls for in the new heaven and the new earth after the final coming of our blessed Lord. And it is a tricky idea to get our heads around and trying to understand this unity between the body and the soul. But even from our first person perspective, we experience this unity. So right now, I am doing all sorts of activities, right?
Right.
So I hear the people in the background. I hear you speaking to me. I am speaking. I am seeing. I'm touching. All of my sensory powers, I'm even tasting, the coffee in my mouth that I was drinking. All of my sensory powers are being utilized right now. But I'm also utilizing powers of the intellectual nature, the rational nature,
right,
such as intellect and will. But I'm using those powers as a single unit, as a single being, using these different powers. So if I weren't a single unified being, as you say, a substantial being,
how would all that work together?
That's right. Yeah. So my mouth would be talking, but I wouldn't.
Yeah, no.
My eyes would be seeing, but I wouldn't be seeing.
It's my body would be doing.
Yeah, so
things.
Even from the first person perspective, we can see that it's not that foreign of an idea to say that we are a unified being. There's a substantial unity to us, and it's the soul that is that principle of unity that united to the body makes it one substantial being.
I just have the feeling that on the day of the resurrection, your soul's going to be a lot happier to go back with that body than my soul's going to be with this body.
The reunification with the body will contribute in a way to the soul's happiness in heaven. Correct.
Marco, calling from Italy, watching on Facebook Live, is next. Marco, your question for Carlo.
Oh, hi. Well, going back to this topic, I wonder how different our body will be in the new creation than the body we have now, if I may ask you.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that's a very good question. In fact, Marco, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, in its section on the resurrection of the body, articulates a few characteristics of the resurrection of the body, pulling from what St. Paul articulates in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So, for example, St. Paul says that our glorified body will take on the characteristic of incorruptibility. So our bodies will no longer be subject to decay and corruption. St. Paul also says that our glorified bodies will be glorified. We will be in glory, which in the tradition of the church has always been interpreted by many as shining, like Jesus says in Matthew 13:43, the just shall shine like the sun. So the holiness and the glory of the soul will, in a sense, overflow into the body, where we will shine like the sun in that glory. And then also, too, St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:49 that our bodies will be like Jesus's resurrected body. So when we look at Jesus's resurrected body, what do we see? For example, in John 20:19, John tells us the doors are locked, and then all of a sudden there's Jesus. Jesus walked through those doors. It's called the gift of subtlety by some, and Aquinas articulates this by a miracle, the possibility of two bodies being in one spatial location at the same time. And guess what? We're going to have the same power. We're going to have the gift of agility to travel at the speed of thought like Jesus did, appearing and disappearing at the blink of an eye.
Hope I see you there, Marco. I am looking forward to it. Thank you. Carla Broussard is our guest, and our topic this hour, which Catholic doctrine troubles you? 888-31-TRUTH is the number.
Catholic Answers Live.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture's moral center continues to fly apart, and with every form of deviance publicly aired and celebrated, we have no choice but to equip our kids to understand about such issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. Silence can no longer be an option. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging on to the shop at Catholic.com.
Did the Catholic Church add books to the Bible? Or did Protestants remove 7 books from the Old Testament? In Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger, author Gary Machuda takes you on a fact-filled tour through the history of the Bible, revealing the whole story behind the lost books of the Protestant Old Testament. With the latest information, discourse on crucial issues, and a topical index, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is a book that belongs in the library of every serious student of Scripture. Order your copy of Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Which Catholic doctrine troubles you? That's our topic this hour. Next hour, Father Hugh Barber is going to be here, and we're going to take questions of a more general spiritual and moral nature. If you've got a spiritual or moral problem you'd like to present to Father, he'll be happy to take it next hour. This hour, Carlo Broussard is our guest. Carlo is the author of Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. And our number, 888-318-7884. Let's go to Veronica in Erie, Pennsylvania. Veronica, your question for Carlo.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
I have a problem here. My husband is not circumcised, and I'm sure that Jesus made a comment or made comments about circumcision during his time here on Earth, but I'm not sure about you know, where the Catholic Church stands on this now.
Okay.
Because I can't address him with this at all.
Well, Veronica, you have hit on probably the biggest controversy of the early church.
Indeed, Veronica. This was the central issue in the first century church concerning the apostles. And it's interesting that we don't find anything within, you know, coming from Jesus' lips himself concerning circumcision. And this is an interesting fact because this was the central issue that the early church had to face, but yet we don't find it coming from the lips of Jesus. Jesus doesn't comment on it in any way, which gives us good reason to trust the apostles in their writings, because they weren't, you know, throwing things back on Jesus to try to justify the problems that they were trying to solve. But so one thing that you discover, Veronica, when you read, for example, St. Paul's letters, for example, in Romans chapter 3, verse 28, when he says, "We are justified by faith and not by the works of the law." One of the things that is central in the mind of St. Paul there is circumcision. For he says immediately after, "For is God a God of the Jews only? Is he not also a God of the Gentiles?" In other words, the standard for salvation, or the principle of salvation, is something that applies both to Jews and Gentiles. That which saves us is no longer restricted to a particular group of people, like circumcision was for the Jews in the old law. For through faith, this is something that can apply both not only to the Jews, but also to Gentiles. And it's by faith and by God's grace that we are saved. And this is what Paul is dealing with in the first century, Veronica, because there were many Jewish converts to Christianity who were teaching that in order to be saved, Jesus is fine, that's great, but you have to still hold fast to the old law and be circumcised and follow all of the precepts of the old law. And this is what Paul is going after and saying no. In fact, when he writes in his letter to the Galatians, in Galatians 5:4, he's talking to some Christians in Galatia who are going back to the old law. And Paul says, "You have fallen from grace," because they were looking to sources of salvation or wells that were dry and empty, right? Because those things of the old law do not have power to save. The power to save is in Jesus Christ and the new law and the new precepts of the new law that Jesus gives us, namely the sacraments, particularly baptism. And in fact, St. Paul in Colossians chapter 2, verses 11 through 12, teaches us in so many words that baptism in the new covenant is our new circumcision. It is the way in which we are circumcised in the heart in the new covenant and entering into a familial relationship with God. And so finally, one last Bible passage, Veronica, you want to look, check out, is in Acts chapter 15. Just read the whole chapter. And therein, what we discover is the early church was dealing with this theological issue. We're told by St. Luke that Paul and Barnabas together could not settle the debate about whether circumcision saves us or no longer saves us. And so Luke tells us they took it up to Jerusalem to consider the matter with the apostles and the elders there. Peter stands up, proclaims the truth of the matter, that we are no longer saved by circumcision. We're saved by grace and by faith. And then James comes up and gives some pastoral proposal on certain obligations that they're going to make on the Gentile Christians in order to keep peace between the Gentiles and the new Jewish converts to the Christian church. And so the whole New Testament, Veronica, deals with this issue that salvation is no longer found in the old law, and in particular through circumcision, but salvation is found in Christ by God's grace with faith. And ultimately, that grace is given to us habitually, that is, in an abiding way in the soul, through the sacrament of baptism in an initial way, and, of course, through the other sacraments of the new covenant.
So, Veronica, does that answer satisfy you, that circumcision is not necessary for salvation?
And it eases my anxiety, because I've had it for such a long time. And I truly believe that Christ in his lifetime, even when he was an infant, showed us what we had to do. And I know the circumcision occurred when the three kings came and circumcised him, and then when he was baptized. So Christ paved the way.
He did indeed, and he left us apostles, however, too. And so
that's right. Christ, in his public ministry, Veronica, gave us new revelation, communicated that new revelation to the apostles, and they transmitted it throughout the succession of the bishops. And so Christ subjected himself to the old law and following the precepts of the law. But in his public ministry, he gives us new revelation, teaching us that that old law is no longer binding, because the new law now has taken its place as far as binding us. That is the law that Christ gives us, the law of love, and everything that is involved with that law.
Veronica, thank you very much. I hope that that does indeed ease your anxiety. Carlo, let us go to Mike in Austin, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Mike, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Carlo.
Hi, guys. So one thing that keeps kind of nagging at my brain is the Orthodox objection to the filioque, saying that it violates Canon 7 of the Council of Ephesus, the Third Ecumenical Council. And so just for reference, the 7th Canon says, the Holy Synod decreed that it is unlawful for any man to bring forward or to write or to compose a different faith as a rival to the established by the Holy Fathers assembled with the Holy Ghost in Nicaea, and then it anathematizes anybody that does that. Can you provide a proper way to interpret this canon with some sort of patristic or other source that would be authoritative to an Orthodox objector?
Yeah, you got me on that, Mike, concerning a source, an authoritative source. I'd have to do a little bit of research on that to try to provide you with something. But I will say this, that, you know, that canon, I haven't looked at it, and I'd have to look at it in more detail. But initially, the first thing that comes to mind is that, remember, you know, obviously there is to be no new revelation, and I would assume that you accept that, Mike, that there's no, so the church can't come and give new revelation, but nevertheless, the church can penetrate the deposit of faith in profound ways and come up with new insights and formulate those insights in ways that are enshrined in definitive teaching in the magisterium, such as in creeds, etc. So, you know, concerning that particular canon, what it is forbidding is for anybody else, right, without the competent authority to be adding to the creed and to be adding to the teachings of the church. But the Holy Father, as the successor to St. Peter, having the universal jurisdiction over God's flock here on earth and the sort of the principle of unity in doctrine and in truth, does have the authority to enshrine new developments, new theological developments and insights that are related to the deposit of faith or found within the deposit of faith and are now made clearer, and to enshrine them in definitive ways, which we see in throughout history as happened with the filioque. You know, my colleague and friend Tim Staples wrote a great article in one of the issues of our Catholic Answers magazine, where he articulates at least the theology behind the filioque. And I'm not quite sure exactly which issue that was, but I'm sure if you would Google Tim Staples, filioque, Catholic Answers magazine, that issue may very well come up, and that might give you some direction on where to go as far as finding some authoritative sources in order to present to Orthodox members.
Mike, thank you very, very much for your call. Carlo Broussard is our guest this hour, and Carlo is the author of Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. And our topic this hour, which Catholic doctrine troubles you? Carlo will be discussing some Catholic doctrine, I imagine, at our upcoming conference, the last weekend in September. That's now written in stone, practically, that every last weekend of September will be the Catholic Answers National Conference. It'll be at the Hyatt Regency La Jolla this year, as it hasn't been in the past. Absolutely beautiful setting, and we'd love you to be there with us. What are you going to be talking about at the conference? The conference itself is called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church.
Yeah,
slightly provocative title. And you'll be talking about
the sacraments.
The earliest church.
Sure, I'll be combing through the writings of the early church fathers and highlighting how they understood the sacraments, such as baptism, the Eucharist, confession, the priesthood, right? And seeing what the early church said. So basically, we're going to get into this time machine, right? We're going to travel back in time, and we're going to see who feels more at home as we're sitting there listening to the preaching of these early Christians. And we're going to see who feels more at home, the Catholic or the Protestant. And we'll see what the evidence shows us.
And you could probably even go widen it out and say the liturgical Christian, the sacraments,
right.
Or the non-liturgical Christian.
That's right. We see, for example, in AD 150, in Justin the Martyr's apology, he's articulating what they did on the first day of the week, on Sunday. And it matches up, you know, part by part with what we do today in the Catholic Mass.
Interesting. I'm really looking forward to that. I like the time machine angle.
Who feels more at home here, you know?
Yep.
And so that's what we're going to do.
All the apologists will be giving talks. We've got Rod Bennett for a guest, Monsignor Eugene Morris, Father David McConey. The keynote speaker will be Bishop Frank Caggiano from Bridgeport, Connecticut. And we've got the early bird pricing and all the good stuff that you get if you sign up early right now. You just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. CatholicAnswersConference.com. We would love to see you there.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
The only thing new about the heresies in the church and the schisms in the church today is it's mixed with satanic worship. We in the church have gone from enneagrams to centering prayer to solstice worship to goddesses. And you buy it as something new.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're not in the studio today. We are with our good friends from EWTN at the Religious Ed Conference. Los Angeles Religious Ed Conference happens this time each year. It's in Anaheim at the Anaheim Convention Center. And we're very, very grateful to EWTN for allowing us to step into their booth and broadcast the show. Live here with us, we have Julie from Ventura with a question. Julie does not want to get on the microphone, but she asked that I convey the question. And I am going to be looking at Julie from Ventura's face as I ask the question to see if I got it right. Jesus taught us many things, and we follow them very strictly. For example, the ordination of men only. But he also chose only 12 apostles. So why do we not follow Jesus in having just 12 apostles or bishops today?
Yeah, very good question. But in fact, we do follow Jesus in only having 12 apostles. The original 12 apostles hold a unique place as foundations, as the foundation of the church, as St. Paul articulates in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 20, that the 12 apostles serve as foundation stones of the church itself. And so the term apostle in its you know, technical sense, is reserved for the original 12. And in fact, this is because Jesus is reconstituting the old Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel, right? Reconstituting the old Israel with the 12 apostles, which is a hint to Jesus' divinity, by the way, because God's the one who called the 12 tribes of Israel, right, through Moses. And here's Jesus, you know, God's calling this new Israel, creating this new Israel to be the fulfillment of the old. So those original, this is why when Judas dies in Acts chapter 1, they elect Matthias to fill his spot as part of the 12. And so he's called an apostle. Now, Paul is a 13th apostle, and he's legitimately called an apostle because he is a witness to the resurrected Lord. So he does come into play as an apostle. But the church has never referred to those who succeeded the apostles as apostles. Now, granted, we use that term in a loose sense, and like an apostle is one who is sent with the authority of the one who sends them. But in the technical sense, that term is reserved for the original 12, including Matthias, and of course St. Paul, because Christ called him in a very unique way. Those who succeed the apostles in the apostolic ministry, we call bishops. And this is what we see in St. Paul's writing. For example, in his letters to Timothy and Titus, in particular 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 2, he says, if any man desires the office of a bishop, right? And the Greek word there for office of a bishop is episcope. And that's the same Greek word that's actually used by St. Luke when he describes Judas's office in Acts chapter 1, I think it's verse 20. So we see a connection between the apostolic office of the apostles, the 12, right, and the office of the bishop. We see that the bishops are successors to the apostles in this role of shepherding God's flock here on earth. But nevertheless, the original 12 do hold a primacy of place. Hence, the term apostles in the technical sense is used only for them, inasmuch as they are the foundation of the church here on earth. Of course, with Peter as the head, there is that visible source and principle of unity. But by way of extension, the apostles also, the 12 also, are considered to be foundation stones, you might say, of the church. So hopefully that's helpful to you.
I think we got the approval of Julie from Ventura. I did a really good job asking the question, didn't you?
Good job,
yes,
Si.
I'm very, very good at fishing for compliments. Let us go now to Mary in Houston, Texas. Mary, your question for Carlo Broussard.
Hi. My question is about living together before marriage. My son suggested that that is a sociologically smart thing to do, but I'd like the moral and sociological data, if you have it, about why that's harmful.
Right. Well, I don't have the sociological data on hand right now, Mary, to share with you, so I apologize for that. But I can make a few comments concerning the morality of it. And this question sort of assumes a whole backlog of thinking and teaching about human sexuality in general. Okay, so it's not just an isolated question that you can answer by itself. It's a question that fits within a whole context of what we know to be the truth about human sexuality. So think about this, Mary. It's not evil in and of itself for a man and a woman who are not married to be under the same roof, right? And sleeping under the same roof. I mean, we can think of extraordinary circumstances where a man and a woman could be under the same roof and be sleeping in that same house and it not be evil in and of itself, okay? So we have to ask the question, well, why does the church forbid cohabitation? Well, it all goes back to, Mary, how we view human sexuality, because we have to ask this question first and give an answer. Namely, why is fornication an evil in and of itself? That is, sexual activity outside of the context of the lifelong bond of marriage. Why is that behavior immoral? Now, granted, we can give and articulate some reasons why it is immoral, because it violates the very natural design and order of our human sexuality being directed to the goal or the purposes of procreation and unitive love. And we can articulate how fornication violates that natural design, that natural order, and consequently is contrary to what's good for us as human beings. Therefore, it's immoral. Okay, once we get that in place and we say that sort of behavior is immoral, well, then we're able to ask the question, well, should a man and a woman who are romantically in love with each other be in under the same roof, living together, putting themselves in a situation that they're going to be tempted in very high degrees, right? They're going to be extremely tempted to engage in that immoral activity. And so because of the immoral activity of fornication, it's that which guides our moral evaluation of whether a man and a woman should be living together under the same roof as husband and wife, right? Now, granted, most of the times when people are cohabitating, they're engaging in the marital act, the act that belongs within marriage. And so it's immoral in that sense. But it's also immoral to be in, to be living together in the same house and cohabitating because they were putting themselves in a near occasion of doing something that's immoral and thus violating their dignity as human beings and impeding them, stopping them, prohibiting them from achieving their ultimate goal of union with God. And so for these reasons, this is sort of a sketch, Mary, of how we would articulate and evaluate the morality of cohabitation and why people ought not to do it. Fundamentally, because it's contrary to their good and their good for them as human beings. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you. But one more thing. Do you have some resources that I can also go to
Sure.
for some more data on it?
Yes. Yeah, so I know our editor here at Catholic Answers, Todd Aglioloro, has a booklet, 20 Answers Marriage. That was published already, I think.
It's out. Yes.
Yeah,
it's out.
So in that booklet, if you just go to shop.catholic.com, type in 20 Answers Marriage, Todd Aglioloro in that booklet addresses cohabitation in a very beautiful way, a very articulate way. Also, too, Mary, concerning the morality of sexual activity, what's moral, what's immoral, and what's the basis for evaluating those types of acts, I would encourage you to go to Catholic.com and in the search engine type sexual sanity. I have quite a few articles that I've written that's published at Catholic.com that sort of lays the groundwork on the natural blueprint, nature's blueprint, you might say, which ultimately comes from the mind of God himself, right? Nature's blueprint for our human sexuality and why certain sexual behaviors such as contraception, same-sex sexual activity, fornication, etc., are contrary to that natural blueprint and thus contrary to our good as human beings and thus contrary to our human happiness.
Mary, thank you very, very much. I might give you just one other source. I was thinking about the Ruth Institute.
Yes.
Because if he's looking for like sociological data and that kind of thing.
I'm sure they have
some magnificent.
Of that. Yeah, amen to that.
Just look up Ruth Institute. I'm not sure if it's a .com or a .org or what it is, but just if you Google Ruth Institute, you'll come to it, Mary. Let's move on. Mary, thank you very much for that call. Let's move on to Armando in Lindsay, California, watching on YouTube Live. Excuse my mispronunciation, Armando. Your question for Carlo.
Awesome to be on the line. First time caller. I listen to you guys all the time. You guys are awesome. I love your work.
Oh, thank you.
My question for you guys has to do with the genealogy of Joseph.
Okay.
I believe in the Old Testament, it reads that Abraham was promised the Messiah to come through his bloodline. And yet Mary was impregnated by the Holy Spirit. So how is it that the promise is fulfilled if Jesus didn't come from from Abraham's bloodline?
Oh, I see. Good question, Armando. Well, there are some scholars who propose the idea that perhaps Mary herself is within that lineage as well. But fundamentally, you know, Jesus, even though Joseph is not his biological father, he still is his legal father. And so by virtue of, you know, adoption there, Jesus has legal rights to the lineage that Joseph comes from. And so by virtue of that adoptive sonship that he has with Joseph, the promises of the seed of Abraham can still be fulfilled. And then, of course, you know, you might do some research on, you know, what scholars have to say about Mary perhaps being in that bloodline as well. So that would be sort of the short answer to it. Those are the two avenues of approach that you might take to try and answer that question in more detail.
Armando, thank you so much for that question. Thanks to everybody who called. Carlo Broussard has been our guest. Carlo's book is Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. You can get that at shop.catholic.com. And like everything else there, it's 15% off right now. And if you want Carlo to come speak at your church or event, just go to catholicanswersspeakers.com. Carlo, you hit it out of the park again.
Thanks, I guarantee they won't be disappointed.
Oh, if you come to their church,
amen,
no, they might have to rebuild it, but they won't be disappointed. Coming up next, we're expecting Father Hugh Barber. We'll see if we can find him, but we got something coming up for you next on Catholic Answers Live.